departed husband, and she missed the sound of little feet, or so she told our father. She would gaze at us wistfully, and call us poor motherless lambs or little angels, though we were ragged enough and none too clean either. I believe she had the idea of making a match with my father. He was putting forth his best qualities and taking some care with himself, and such a man, so recently bereaved and with so many children, must have seemed to Mrs. Burt like a fruit ready to fall from the tree. She used to have him into the front part of the house to console him. She said that none knew better than a widow like herself what it was to lose a spouse. It knocked a body down, and such were in need of a true and sympathizing friend, one who could share in his sorrows. And she let on that she was just the one for the job, and she may have been right about that, as there were no others applying for it. As for our father, he took the hint and played up, and went round like a man half-stunned, with a handkerchief always at the ready, and he said his heart had been torn alive out of his body, and whatever was he going to do without his beloved helpmeet by his side, now in heaven, having been too good for this earth and all these innocent little mouths to feed? I used to listen to him going on in Mrs. Burt's parlour, the wall between the two parts of the house being none too thick, and if you put a tumbler to the wall and your ear against the other end of it, you can hear even better. We did have three tumblers, as Mrs. Burt had lent them to us, and I tried them all in turn and soon picked out the best one for the purpose. I'd found it hard enough when our mother died, but attempted to keep myself together through it all, and to put my shoulder to the wheel. And to hear my father snivelling away in that fashion was enough to turn the stomach. I believe it was only then that I truly began to hate him, especially considering how he had treated our mother in life no better than if she had been a rag for cleaning his boots. And I knew, although Mrs. Burt did not, that it was all put on, and that he was working on her feelings because he was behind in the rent, having taken the money for it to the nearest tavern. And then he sold my mother's china cups with the roses, and although I begged for the broken teapot, he sold that too, as he said it was a clean break and could be mended. And our mother's shoes went the same way, and our best sheet. And I might as well have used it to bury my poor mother, as would have been right. He would go out of the house as jaunty as a rooster, pretending to look for work, but I knew where he was off to. I could tell by the smell of him when he came back. I would watch him swaggering down the lane and tucking his handkerchief back into his pocket. And soon enough Mrs. Burt gave up on her plan of consolation, and there was no more tea parties in the parlour. And she stopped the supply of milk and bread to us, and asked for her tumblers back, and for the rent to be paid, or she would have us all turned out, bag and baggage. That was when our father began to tell me I was almost a grown woman now, and I was eating him out of house and home. It was time I went out into the world to earn my own bread, as my sister had done before me, although she had never sent enough of her wages back, the ungrateful slut. And when I asked who would look after the little ones, he said my next sister, Katie, would do it. She was 9 years old, although halfway to 10, and I saw there was no help for it. I did not have any notion about how to get a position, but I asked Mrs. Burt, she being the only person in the town I knew. She now wanted to be rid of us, and who was to blame her? But she saw in me a hope of being repaid. She had a friend who knew the housekeeper at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's, and she'd heard that they were short a pair of hands, so she told me to tidy myself up, and lent me a clean cap of her own, and took me there herself, and presented me to the housekeeper. She said I was a very willing and hard worker of good character, and she would vouch for it herself. Then she told about my mother having died on board ship and being buried at sea, and the housekeeper agreed that it was a shame and looked at me more closely. I've noticed there's nothing like a death to get your foot in the door. The housekeeper was called Mrs. Honey, although she was sweet only in name, being a dried-up woman with a pointed nose like a candle-snuffer. She looked as if she lived on stale crusts and cheese parings, which she most likely had done in her life, being an English gentlewoman in distress, who was only a housekeeper through the death of her husband, and being stranded in this country and having no money of her own. Mrs. Burt told her I was 13, and I did not contradict her. She'd warned me beforehand that it would be the best way, as I would stand a better chance of being hired, and it was not entirely a lie, as I would be 13 indeed in under a month's time. Mrs. Honey looked at me with a pinched mouth, and said I was very scrawny, and she hoped I was not ill with anything, and what had my mother died of? But Mrs. Burt said nothing catching, and I was just a trifle small for my age, and hadn't yet got my full growth, but I was very wiry, and she'd seen me carrying stacks of wood around, just like a man. Mrs. Honey took this for what it was worth and sniffed, and asked if I was bad-tempered, as red-headed people frequently were. And Mrs. Burt said I had the sweetest temper in the world and had borne all my troubles with Christian resignation like a saint. This reminded Mrs. Honey to ask if I was a Catholic, as those from Ireland generally were, and if so, she would have nothing to do with me, as the Catholics were superstitious and rebellious papists who were ruining the country. But she was relieved to hear that I was not. And Mrs. Honey asked if I could sew, and Mrs. Burr said I could sew like the wind. And Mrs. Honey asked me directly if this was true, and I spoke up for myself, although nervous, and said I'd helped my mother make shirts from an early age and could do the best buttonholes and men's stockings, and I remembered to say ma'am. Then Mrs. Honey hesitated, as if adding up sums in her head, and then she asked to look at my hands. Perhaps she wished to see if they were the hands of a person who'd been working hard, but she needn't have bothered her head, as they were red and rough as could be desired, and she appeared satisfied. You would have thought she was trading a horse. I was surprised she did not ask to look at my teeth. But I suppose if you pay out wages, you want to get a good return on them. The upshot was that Mrs. Honey consulted with Mrs. Alderman Parkinson and sent word the next day that I was to come. My wages were to be board and a dollar a month, which was the lowest she could in conscience pay. But Mrs. Burt said I could command more once I had some training and had grown older. And a dollar bought more at that time than it does now. As for me, I was delighted to be earning money of my own and thought it a fortune. My father had the idea that I would go back and forth between the two houses and sleep at home, which was what he called our two rickety rooms, and continue to get up first thing every morning and light the brute of a stove and boil the kettle and then tidy up at the end of the day and wash the laundry into the bargain, what laundry we were able to do, there not being any sort of copper. And it was useless asking my father to spend money on even the worst kind of soap. But at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's they wanted me to live in, and I was to come at the beginning of the week. And although I was sorry to part with my brothers and sisters, I was thankful that I had to go away, because if not, it would soon have come to bones broken between myself and my father. The older I became, the less I was able to please him, and I myself had lost all of a child's natural faith in a parent, as he was drinking up the bread out of his own children's mouths, and soon he would force us to begging or thieving, or worse. Also his rages had returned, stronger than before my mother died. Already my arms were black and blue, and then one night he threw me against the wall, as he'd sometimes done with my mother, shouting that I was a slut and a whore, and I fainted. And after that I feared he might some day break my spine and make a cripple out of me. But after these rages he would wake up in the morning and say he couldn't remember a thing about it, and he hadn't been himself, and he didn't know what had got into him. Although I was dog-tired at the end of each day, I would lie awake at night brooding over it. It was the never knowing when he would go off his head like that and start rampaging about, and threaten to kill this or that person, including his own children, for no reason that anybody could see at all, apart from the drink. I had begun to have thoughts about the iron cooking pot, and how heavy it was, and if it should happen to drop on him while he was asleep, it could smash his skull open and kill him dead. And I would say it was an accident, and I did not want to be led into a grave sin of that kind, though I was afraid that the fiery red anger that was in my heart against him would drive me to it. So as I made ready to go to Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's, I thanked God for taking me out of the path of temptation and prayed that he would keep me out of it in the times ahead. Mrs. Burt kissed me goodbye and wished me well, and despite her fat, mottled face and her smell of smoked fish, I was glad of it, because in this world you have to take your bits and ends of kindness where you can find them, as they do not grow on trees. The little ones cried as I went away, carrying my small bundle, including my mother's shawl, and I said I would come back and visit them, and at the time I meant it. My father was not at home when I left. It was just as well, as I'm sorry to say it would most likely have been curses both ways, although silent on my part. It is always a mistake to curse back openly at those who are stronger than you, unless there is a fence between. From Dr. Simon Jordan, care of Major C.D. Humphrey, Lower Union Street, Kingston, Canada West, to Dr. Edward Murchie, Dorchester, Massachusetts, the United States of America, May 15th, 1859. My dear Edward, I am writing this by the light of the midnight oil which we have so often burned together in this damnably chilly house, which is fully equal to our London lodgings in that respect. But soon it will grow too hot, and the dark miasmas and summer diseases will be upon us, and I will complain about those in their turn. I thank you for your letter, and for the welcome news it contains. So you have proposed yourself to the lovely Cornelia, and have been accepted. You will forgive an old friend for not expressing any great surprise, as the matter was writ large enough between the lines of your letters, and could easily be divined without any great perspicacity on the reader's part. Please accept my earnest congratulations. From what I know of Miss Rutherford, you are a lucky dog. At moments like this, I envy those who have found a safe haven in which to bestow their hearts, or perhaps I envy them for having a heart to bestow. I often feel that I myself am without one, and possess in its stead merely a heart-shaped stone, and am therefore doomed to wander lonely as a cloud, as Wordsworth put it. The news of your engagement will no doubt invigorate my dear mother, and spur her on to even greater matrimonial efforts on my behalf, and I have no doubt that you will be used against me, as a prime example of rectitude, and as a stick to beat me with at every opportunity. Well, no doubt she is in the right. Sooner or later I must set aside my scruples and obey the biblical command to be fruitful and multiply. I must give my stony heart into the keeping of some kindly damsel who will not mind too much that it is not a real heart of flesh, and who will also have the material means necessary to care for it. For hearts of stone are notoriously more demanding of their comforts than the other kind. Despite this deficiency of mine, my dear mother continues her matrimonial scheming. She is currently singing the praises of Miss Faith Cartwright, whom you will remember encountering several years ago during one of your visits to us. She is supposed to have been much improved by a sojourn in Boston, which to my certain knowledge, and to yours too, my dear Edward, for you were with me as an undergraduate at Harvard, has never improved anyone else. But from the way my mother hymns the young lady's moral virtues, I fear that the rectification of the deficiencies in her other charms has not been among the improvements. Alas, it is a type of maiden other than the worthy and spotless Faith, who would have the power to transform your cynical old friend into the semblance of a lover. But enough of my grumblings and repinings. I'm heartily glad for you, my dear fellow, and will dance at your wedding with the greatest goodwill in the world, provided that I am in your vicinity when the nuptials take place. You have been kind enough, in the midst of your raptures, to inquire as to my progress with Grace Marks. I have, as yet, little to report, but as the methods I am employing are gradual and cumulative in their effects, I did not expect rapid results. My object is to wake the part of her mind that lies dormant, to probe down below the threshold of her consciousness, and to discover the memories that must perforce lie buried there. I approach her mind as if it is a locked box, to which I must find the right key, but so far I must admit I have not got very far with it. It would be helpful to me if she were indeed mad, or at least a little madder than she appears to be, but thus far she has manifested a composure that a duchess might envy. I've never known any woman to be so thoroughly self-contained. Apart from the incident at the time of my arrival, which I was unfortunately too late to witness, there have been no more outbursts. Her voice is low and melodious, and more cultivated than is usual in a servant, a trick she has learned, no doubt, through her long service in the house of her social superiors, and she retains barely a trace of the Northern Irish accent with which she must have arrived, although that is not so remarkable, as she was only a child at the time and has now spent more than half her life on this continent. She sits on a cushion and sews a fine seam, cool as a cucumber, and with her mouth primmed up like a governess's, and I lean my elbows on the table across from her, cudgeling my brains, and trying in vain to open her up like an oyster. Although she converses in what seems a frank enough manner, she manages to tell me as little as possible, or as little as possible of what I want to learn. Although I have managed to ascertain a good deal about her family situation as a child and about her crossing of the Atlantic as an emigrant. But none of it is very far out of the ordinary, only the usual poverty and hardships, etc. Those who believe in the hereditary nature of insanity might take some comfort in the fact that her father was an inebriate, and possibly an arsonist as well. But, despite several theories to the contrary, I am far from being convinced that such tendencies are necessarily inherited. As for myself, if it were not for the fascination her case affords, I might run mad myself, out of sheer boredom. There is little enough society here, and none who share my sentiments and interests, with the possible exception of one Dr. DuPont, who is a visitor here like myself, but he is a devotee of the Scottish crackpot braid and a queer duck himself. As for amusements and recreations, there are few to be had, and I have decided to ask my landlady if I may dig in her back garden, which has been let go sadly to waste, and plant a few cabbages and so forth, just for the distraction and the exercise. You see what I am driven to, who have scarcely lifted a spade before in my life. But now it is past midnight, and I must close this letter to you and go to my cold and lonely bed. I send you my best thoughts and wishes, and trust that you are living more profitably and are less perplexed than is your old friend, Simon. 6. Secret Drawer. Hysterics. These fits take place, for the most part, in young, nervous, unmarried women. Young women who are subject to these fits are apt to think that they are suffering from all the ills that flesh is heir to, and the false symptoms of disease which they show are so like the true ones that it is often exceedingly difficult to detect the difference. The fits themselves are mostly preceded by great depression of spirits, shedding of tears, sickness, palpitation of the heart, etc. The patient now generally becomes insensible and faints. The body is thrown about in all directions. Froth issues from the mouth, incoherent expressions are uttered, and fits of laughter, crying, or screaming take place. When the fit is going off, the patient mostly cries bitterly, sometimes knowing all, and at other times nothing, of what has taken place. Isabella Beaton. Beaton's Book of Household Management, 1859-61. My heart would hear her and beat, were it earth in an earthy bed. My dust would hear her and beat, had I lain for a century dead, would start and tremble under her feet, and blossom in purple and red. Alfred Lord Tennyson, Maud, 1855. Simon is dreaming of a corridor. It's the attic passageway of his house, his old house, the house of his childhood, the big house they had before his father's failure and death. The maids slept up here. It was a secret world, one as a boy he wasn't supposed to explore, but did, creeping silent as a spy in his stocking feet, listening at half-open doors. What did they talk about when they thought no one could hear? When he was feeling very brave, he would venture into their rooms, knowing they were downstairs. With a shiver of excitement, he'd examine their things, their forbidden things. He'd slide open the drawers, touch the wooden comb with two broken teeth, the carefully rolled ribbon. He'd rummage in the corners, behind the door, the crumpled petticoat, the cotton stocking, only one. He'd touched it. It felt warm. In his dream, the passageway is the same, only bigger. The walls are taller and yellower, glowing as if the sun itself is shining through them, but the doors are closed and also locked. He tries door after door, lifting the latch, pushing gently, but nothing yields. There are people in there, though, he can sense them. Women, the maids, sitting on the edges of their narrow beds in their white cotton shifts, their hair unbound and rippling down over their shoulders, their lips parted, their eyes gleaming, waiting for him. The door at the end opens. Inside it is the sea. Before he can stop himself, down he goes, the water closing over his head, a stream of silvery bubbles rising from him. In his ears he hears a ringing, a faint and shivery laughter. Then many hands caress him. It's the maid. Only they can swim. But now they are swimming away from him, abandoning him. He calls out to them, "Help me!" But they are gone. He's clinging on to something, a broken chair. The waves are rising and falling. Despite this turbulence, there is no wind and the air is piercingly clear. Past him, just out of reach, various objects are floating, a silver tray, a pair of candlesticks, a mirror, an engraved snuff box, a gold watch, which is making a chirping noise like a cricket. Things that were his father's once, but sold after his death. They're rising up from the depths like bubbles. More and more of them. As they reach the surface, they roll slowly over like bloating fish. They aren't hard like metal, but soft. They have a scaly skin on them like an eel's. He watches in horror, because now they're gathering, twining together, reforming. Tentacles are growing. A dead hand, his father, in the sinuous process of coming back to life. He has an overwhelming sense of having transgressed. He wakes. His heart is pounding. The sheets and comforter are tangled around him. The pillows are on the floor. He's soaked with sweat. After he's lain quietly for a time, reflecting, he thinks he understands the train of association that must have led to such a dream. It was Grace's story, with its Atlantic crossing, its burial at sea, its catalogue of household objects, and the overbearing father, of course. One father leads to another. He checks the time by his pocket watch, which is on the small bedside table. For once he slept in. Luckily, his breakfast is late, but the surly Dora should be arriving at any moment, and he doesn't want to be surprised by her in his nightshirt, caught out in sloth. He throws on his dressing gown and seats himself quickly at his writing table, turning his back to the door. He will record the dream he's just had in the journal he keeps for such purposes. One school of French alienists recommend the recording of dreams as a diagnostic tool, their own dreams, as well as those of their patients, for the sake of comparison. They hold dreams, like somnambulism, to be a manifestation of the animal life that continues below consciousness, out of sight, beyond reach of the will. Perhaps the hooks, the hinges, as it were, in the chain of memory, are located there. He must reread Thomas Brown's work on association and suggestion, and Herbart's theory of the threshold of consciousness, the line that divides those ideas that are apprehended in full daylight from those others that lurk forgotten in the shadows below. Moreau de Tours considers the dream to be the key to the knowledge of mental illness, and Maine de Biran held that conscious life was only a sort of island, floating upon a much vaster subconscious, and drawing thoughts up from it like fish. What is perceived as being known is only a small part of what may be stored in this dark repository. Lost memories lie down there like sunken treasure to be retrieved piecemeal, if at all. And amnesia itself may be, in effect, a sort of dreaming in reverse, a drowning of recollection, a plunging under. Behind his back, the door opens. His breakfast is making its entrance. Assiduously, he dips his pen. He waits for the thump of the tray, the clatter of earthenware on wood. But he does not hear it. "Just set it on the table, will you?" he says, without turning. There is a sound like air going out of a small bellows, followed by a shattering crash. Simon's first thought is that Dora has hurled the tray at him. She has always suggested to his mind a barely repressed and potentially criminal violence. He shouts involuntarily, leaps up, and whirls around. Lying full length upon the floor is his landlady, Mrs. Humphrey, in a shambles of broken crockery and ruined food. He hurries over to her, kneels, and takes her pulse. At least she is still alive. He rolls open an eyelid, sees the opaque white. Swiftly, he undoes the none-too-clean bibbed apron which she is wearing and which he recognizes as the one habitually worn by slovenly Dora. Then he unbuttons the front of her dress, noticing as he does so that there is a button missing, with the thread still hanging in place. He rummages around inside the layers of cloth and at last succeeds in cutting her stay laces with his pocket knife, releasing an odor of violet water, autumn leaves, and humid flesh. There is more to her than he would have supposed, although she is far from plump. He carries her into his bedroom. The settee in his sitting room is too small for the purpose. and extends her upon the bed, placing a pillow beneath her feet to cause the blood to run back into her head. He considers removing her boots, which haven't been cleaned yet today, but decides that this would be an unwarranted familiarity. Mrs. Humphrey has neat ankles from which he averts his eyes. Her hair is disheveled from the fall. Seen this way, she is younger than he thought, and with her habitual expression of strained anxiety wiped away by unconsciousness, much more attractive. He sets his ear against her breast, listening. The heartbeat is regular. A simple case of fainting, then. He moistens a towel with water from the jug and applies it to her face and neck. Her eyelids twitch. Simon pours half a glass of water from the bottle on his nightstand, adds 20 drops of sal volatile, a medication he always carries with him on his afternoon visits in case of any similar flimsiness on the part of Grace Marks, who is said to be prone to fainting, and supporting Mrs. Humphrey with one arm, holds the glass to her lips. Swallow this. She gulps awkwardly, then lifts a hand to her head. There is a red mark, he notices now, on the side of her face. Perhaps her scoundrel of a husband is a brute as well as a sot, though this looks more like a hard slap, and surely such a man as the Major would employ a closed fist. Simon feels a wave of protective pity for her that he cannot really afford. This woman is only his landlady. Apart from that, she's a complete stranger to him. He has no wish to alter this situation, despite an image that leaps into his mind unbidden, aroused no doubt by the sight of a helpless woman extended upon his tumbled bed, of Mrs. Humphrey, semi-conscious and with her hands fluttering helplessly in the air, minus her stays and with her chemise half torn off, her feet, curiously still in their boots, kicking spasmodically, making faint mewing noises while being savaged by a hulking figure that bears no resemblance at all to himself, although from above and from the back, which is his point of view during this sordid scene, the quilted dressing gown looks identical. He has always been curious about these manifestations of the imagination as he has been able to observe them in himself. Where do they come from? If they occur in him, they must occur as well in the majority of men. He is both sane and normal, and he has developed the rational faculties of his mind to a high degree, and yet he cannot always control such pictures. The difference between a civilized man and a barbarous fiend, a madman, say, lies perhaps merely in the thin veneer of willed self-restraint. "You are quite safe," he says to her kindly. "You have had a fall. You must rest quietly until you feel better."
"But I am on a bed."
She gazes around her.
"It is my bed, Mrs. Humphrey. I was forced to carry you to it in the absence of any other suitable place."
The skin of her face is now flushed. She has noticed his dressing gown.
"I must leave at once."
"I beg you to remember that I am a doctor, and for the time being you are my patient. If you were to attempt to get up now, there might be a recurrence."
"Recurrence?"
"You collapsed while carrying in,
it seems indelicate to mention it,
my breakfast tray. May I ask you what has become of Dora?"
To his consternation, but not to his surprise, she begins to cry.
"I could not pay her. I owed her 3 months' back wages. I had succeeded in selling some items of a personal nature, but my husband took the money from me 2 days ago. He has not been back since. I do not know where he has gone."
She makes a visible effort to control her tears.
"And this morning?"
"We had words. She insisted on payment. I told her I could not, that it was not possible. She said in that case she would pay herself. She began to go through my bureau drawers in search of jewelry, I suppose. Not finding any, she said she would have my wedding ring. It was gold, but very plain. I attempted to defend it from her. She said I was not honest. She struck me. Then she took it, and said she would not be an unpaid slave to me any longer, and then she left the house. After that, I prepared your breakfast myself and carried it up. What else was I to do?"
"So it was not the husband, then," thinks Simon. "It was that sow of a Dora,
Mrs. Humphrey begins to cry again, gently, effortlessly, as if the sobs are a kind of bird song.
You must have some good woman friend you can go to, or who will come to you.
Simon is anxious to transfer Mrs. Humphrey from his own shoulders to those of someone else.
Women help each other. Caring for the afflicted is their sphere. They make beef tea and jellies. They knit comforting shawls. They pat and soothe.
I have no friends in this place. We have only recently come to this city, having undergone some financial difficulties in our previous abode. My husband discouraged visits. He did not want me going out.
A useful thought comes to Simon. You must eat something. You will feel stronger.
At this, she smiles wanly at him. There is nothing in the house to eat, Dr. Jordan.
Your breakfast was the last of it. I have not eaten for 2 days, ever since my husband left.
What little there was, Dora ate up herself. I have had nothing but water.
And so Simon finds himself at the market, purchasing stores for the physical maintenance of his landlady with his own money. He'd helped Mrs. Humphrey down the stairs to her own part of the house. She'd insisted on it, saying she could not afford to be found in the bedroom of her lodger in the event of her husband's return. He wasn't surprised to find that the rooms were essentially bare of furniture. A table and 2 chairs were all that remained in the parlor, but there was still a bed in the back bedroom, and onto it he had placed Mrs. Humphrey in a state of nervous exhaustion. And starvation, too. No wonder she was so bony. He turned his mind away from the bed and from the scenes of conjugal misery that must have been enacted upon it. Then he went back upstairs to his own rooms, with a slop pail he'd located. The kitchen had been a shambles. He'd cleaned up the spilled breakfast and the broken dishes from the floor, noting that, for once, the now ruined egg had been perfectly cooked. He supposes he will have to give notice to Mrs. Humphrey and change his lodgings, which will be an inconvenience, although preferable to the disruption of his life and work that would surely be the consequence if he were to stay. Disorder, chaos, the bailiff's men coming for the furniture in his own chambers, no doubt. But if he leaves, what will become of the wretched woman? He does not want her on his conscience, which is where she will be if she starves to death on a street corner. He buys some eggs, and some bacon and cheese, and some dirty-looking butter from an old farm woman at one of the stalls, and at a shop some tea twisted up in a paper. He would like bread, but there is none to be seen. He doesn't really know how to go about this. He's visited the market before, but only fleetingly, to obtain the vegetables with which he has been hoping to prod Grace's memory. Now he's on a different footing entirely. Where can he purchase milk? Why are there no apples? This is a universe he has never explored, having no curiosity about where his food came from, as long as it did come. The other shoppers at the market are servants, their mistresses' shopping baskets over their arms, or else women of the poorer classes in limp bonnets and bedraggled shawls. He feels they are laughing at him behind his back. When he returns, Mrs. Humphrey is up. She's wrapped herself in a quilt and tidied her hair, and is sitting beside the stove, which is luckily alight. He himself would not know how to manage it, rubbing her hands together and shivering. He succeeds in making her some tea and in frying some eggs and bacon, and in toasting a stale bun, which he eventually found at the market. They eat these together at the one remaining table. He wishes there were some marmalade.
This is so good of you, Dr. Jordan.
Think nothing of it. I could not let you starve.
His voice is heartier than he intends, the voice of a jolly and insincere uncle who can scarcely wait to bestow the expected quarter dollar on the groveling poor relation niece, pinch her cheek, and then make his getaway to the opera. Simon wonders what the bad Major Humphrey is doing right now, and curses him silently, and envies him. Whatever it may be, it is more enjoyable than this. Mrs. Humphrey sighs. I'm afraid it will come to that. I am at the end of my resources.
She is now quite calm, and is looking at her situation objectively.
The rent of the house must be paid, and there is no money. Soon they will come like vultures to pick over the bones, and I will be turned out. Perhaps I will even be arrested for debt.
I would rather die.
Surely there must be something you can do, says Simon, to earn a living. She is clutching for her self-respect, and he admires her for it.
She gazes at him. Her eyes, in this light, are an odd shade of sea green.
What do you suggest, Dr. Jordan?
Fancy needlework?
Women like me have few skills they can sell.
There's a hint of malicious irony in her voice. Does she know what he was thinking as she lay unconscious on his unmade bed?
I will advance you another 2 months' rent, he finds himself saying.
He's a fool, a soft-hearted idiot. If he had any sense, he would be out of here as if the devil himself were in pursuit.
That should be sufficient to hold the wolves at bay, at least until you've had time to consider your prospects.
Her eyes fill with tears. Without a word, she lifts his hand from the table and presses it gently to her lips. The effect is only slightly dampened by the trace of butter that remains upon her mouth. Today, Dr. Jordan looks more disarranged than usual, and as if he has something on his mind. He does not seem to know quite how to begin, so I continue with my sewing until he's had time to gather himself together, and then he says, "Is that a new quilt you're working on, Grace?" And I say, "Yes, it is, sir. It is a Pandora's box for Miss Lydia." This puts him in an instructive mood, and I can see he is going to teach me something, which gentlemen are fond of doing. Mr. Kinnear was like that as well. And he says, "And do you know who Pandora was, Grace?" And I say, "Yes, she was a Greek person from days of old who looked into a box she had been told not to, and a lot of diseases came out, and wars, and other human ills. For I had learned it a long time ago, at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's. Mary Whitney had a low opinion of the story, and said why did they leave such a box lying around if they didn't want it opened?" He is surprised to find I know that, and says, "But do you know what was at the bottom of the box?" "Yes, sir," I say.
"It was hope." "And you could make a joke out of it, and say that hope was what you got when you scraped the bottom of the barrel, as some do who have to marry, at last, out of desperation. Or you could say it was a hope chest. But in any case, it is all just a fable, although a pretty quilt pattern."
"Well, I suppose we all need a little hope now and then," he says. And I am on the point of saying that I have been getting along without it for some time. But I refrain. And then I say, "You do not look yourself today, sir. I trust you are not ill." And he smiles his one-sided smile and says he isn't ill, only preoccupied. But that if I would continue with my story, it would be a help to him, as it would distract him from his worries. But he does not say what these worries might be. And so I go on. "Now, sir," I say, "I will come to a happier part of my story. And in this part I will tell you about Mary Whitney, and then you will understand why it was her name I borrowed when I was in need of it, for she was never one to refuse a friend in need, and I hope I stood by her as well when the time came for it. The house of my new employment was very grand, and was known as one of the finest houses in Toronto. It was situated on Front Street, overlooking the lake, where there were many other big houses, and it had a curved portico with white pillars at the front. The dining room was oval in shape, as was the drawing room, and a marvel to behold, although draughty. And there was a library as big as a ballroom, with shelves up to the ceiling, all stuffed full of books in leather covers, with more words in them than you would ever want to read in your life. And the bedchambers had high tester bedsteads with hangings, and also nettings to keep out the flies in summer, and dressing tables with looking glasses, and mahogany commodes, and chests of drawers, all complete. They were Church of England, as all the best people were in those days, and also those who wanted to be the best, as it was established. The family consisted first of Mr. Alderman Parkinson, who was seldom visible, as he was much engaged in business and politics. He was the shape of an apple with two sticks stuck into it for legs. He had so many gold watch chains and gold pins and gold snuff boxes and other trinkets, you could have got five necklaces out of him if he was melted down, with the earrings to match. Then there was Mrs. Alderman Parkinson, and Mary Whitney said she ought to have been the alderman herself, as she was the better man. She was an imposing figure of a woman, and a very different shape out of her corsets than in them. But when she was firmly laced in, her bosom jutted out like a shelf, and she could have carried a whole tea service around on it and never spilt a drop. She came from the United States of America, and had been a well-to-do widow before being, as she said, swept off her feet by Mr. Alderman Parkinson, which must have been a sight to behold. And Mary Whitney said it was a wonder Mr. Alderman Parkinson had escaped with his life. She had two grown sons who were away at college in the States, and also a spaniel dog named Bevelina, which I include as family because it was treated as such. I am fond of animals as a rule, but this one took an effort. Then there were the servants, which were many in number, and some left and others came while I was there, so I will not mention them all. There was Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's lady's maid, who claimed to be French, though we had our doubts, and kept to herself, and Mrs. Honey, the housekeeper, who had quite a large room at the back of the main floor, and so did the butler, and the cook and laundress lived next the kitchen. The gardener and stableman lived in the outbuildings, as did the two kitchen maids, near the stable with the horses and three cows, where I went sometimes to help with the milking. I was put in the attic, at the very top of the back stairs, and shared a bed with Mary Whitney, who helped in the laundry. Our room was not large, and hot in summer and cold in winter, as it was next to the roof and without a fireplace or stove, and in it was the bedstead, which had a pallet mattress filled with straw, and a small chest, and a plain washstand with a chipped basin, and a chamber pot, and also a straight-backed chair painted a light green where we folded our clothes at night. Down the passageway from us were Agnes and Effie, who were the chambermaids. Agnes was of a religious temperament, although kind-hearted and helpful. In her youth she had tried a preparation for taking the yellow off the teeth, but it took the white off as well, which may have been why she smiled so seldom, and took care to do it with her lips closed. Mary Whitney said she prayed so much because she was praying to God to get her white teeth back again, but so far no results. Effie had become very melancholic when her young man was transported to Australia for being in the rebellion 3 years before, and when she got a letter saying he had died there, she attempted to hang herself by her apron strings, but they broke, and she was found on the floor half-choked and out of her mind, and had to be put away. I knew nothing about the rebellion, not having been in the country at the time, so Mary Whitney told me. It was against the gentry, who ran everything and kept all the money and land for themselves, and it was led by Mr. William Lyon Mackenzie, who was a radical, and after the rebellion failed he escaped through ice and snow in women's clothing and over the lake to the States, and he could have been betrayed many times over but was not, because he was a fine man who had always stood up for the ordinary farmers, but many of the radicals had been caught and transported or hanged, and had lost their property, or else had gone south, and most of those left here were Tories, or said they were, so it was best not to mention politics, except among friends. I said I understood nothing about politics, so would not think of mentioning it in any case, and I asked Mary if she was a radical, and she said I was not to tell the Parkinsons, who had heard a different story, but her own father had lost his farm that way, which he had cleared himself with much labor, and they had burnt the log house he'd built with his own two hands while fighting off the bears and other wild animals. And then he'd lost his life, too, through illness caused by hiding in the winter woods, and her mother had died of grief. But their time would come, they would be revenged. And she looked very fierce as she said this. I was pleased to be with Mary Whitney, as I liked her at once. Next to me, she was the youngest one there, being 16, and she was a pretty and cheerful girl, with a tidy figure and dark hair and sparkling black eyes, and rosy cheeks with dimples, and she smelled like nutmegs or carnations. She asked all about me, and I told her about the journey in the ship, and about my mother dying and sinking down into the sea among the icebergs, and Mary said that was very sad, and then I told her about my father, although keeping back the worst parts, because it's not right to speak ill of a parent, and how I feared he would want all of my wages, and she said I should not give him my money, as he had not worked for it, and it would not benefit my sisters and brothers, as he would spend it all on himself and most likely on the drink. I said I was afraid of him, and she said he could not get at me here, and if he tried, she would speak to Jim in the stables, who was a large man with friends, and I began to feel easier. Mary said I might be very young and as ignorant as an egg, but I was bright as a new penny, and the difference between stupid and ignorant was that ignorant could learn. And she said I looked like a good worker who would pull my weight, and we would get along fine together. And she'd had two other situations, and if you had to hire yourself out as a servant, it was as well at Parkinson's as anywhere, as they did not stint on the meals. And this was true, as I soon began to fill out and grow taller. Food was certainly easier to come by in the Canadas than on the other side of the ocean, and there was a greater variety of it. And even the servants ate meat every day, if only salt pork or bacon, and there was good bread, of wheat, and also of Indian corn. And the house had its own three cows, and kitchen garden, and fruit trees, and strawberries, currants, and grapes, and flower beds as well. Mary Whitney was a fun-loving girl, and very mischievous and bold in her speech when we were alone. But towards her elders and betters her manner was respectful and demure, and because of that and the brisk way she did her work, she was a general favorite. But behind their backs she made jokes about them, and imitated their faces and walks and ways. I was often astonished at the words that came out of her mouth, as many of them were quite coarse. And it wasn't that I'd never heard such language before, as there was a sufficient store of it at home when my father was drunk, and on the ship coming over, and down by the harbor near the taverns and inns. But I was surprised to hear it from a girl, and one so young and pretty, and so neatly and cleanly dressed. But I soon got used to it, and put it down to her being a native-born Canadian, as she did not have much respect for degree. And sometimes when I would be shocked at her, she would say that I would soon be singing mournful hymns like Agnes, and going around with the mouth pulled down all glum and saggy like an old maid's backside, and I would protest, and we would end by laughing. But it angered her that some people had so much and others so little, as she could not see any divine plan in it. She claimed that her grandmother had been a Red Indian, which was why her hair was so black, and that if she had half a chance she would run away to the woods and go about with a bow and arrow and not have to pin up her hair or wear stays. And I could come with her, and then we would fall to planning about how we would hide in the forest and leap out upon travelers and scalp them, which she had read about in books. And she said she would like to scalp Mrs. Alderman Parkinson, except it would not be worth the trouble, as her hair was not her own. There were hanks and swatches of it kept in her dressing room. And she'd once seen the French maid brushing a heap of it, and thought it was the spaniel. But it was just our way of talking, and no harm was meant. Mary took me under her wing from the first. She soon guessed that I wasn't as old as I said I was, and she swore not to tell. And then she looked over my clothes and said most of them were too small for me and fit only for the scrap bag, and that I would never make it through the winter with only my mother's shawl, as the wind would go right through it like a sieve. And she would help me get the clothes I needed, as Mrs. Honey had told her I looked like a ragamuffin, and I was to be made presentable, since Mrs. Alderman Parkinson had her name to keep up in the neighborhood. But first I must be scrubbed like a potato. I was that filthy. She said she would get the loan of Mrs. Honey's hip bath, and I was alarmed, as I had never been in a bath of any sort, and also I was afraid of Mrs. Honey. But Mary said her bark was worse than her bite, and in any case you could always hear her coming, as she clanked like a wagon full of old kettles because of all her keys. And if there was any argument, she would threaten to bathe me outside, stark naked, under the pump in the back courtyard. I was shocked by this and said I would not allow it, and she said of course she would never do such a thing, but the mere mention of it would obtain Mrs. Honey's consent. Back she came quite soon, and said we could have the hip bath as long as we scoured it well out afterwards, and we took it to the laundry room, and pumped the water and took the chill off it on the stove, and poured it in. I made Mary stand at the door to prevent anyone from coming in, and with her back turned, as I had never taken off all my clothes at once before, though I kept my shift on out of modesty. The water was not very warm, and by the time I'd finished I was shivering, and it was a good thing it was summertime or I would have caught my death of cold. Mary said I had to wash my hair as well, and though it was true that washing it too much would take all the strength out of your body, and she had known a girl who had faded away and died from too much hair washing, still it needed to be done every 3 or 4 months. And she looked at my head and said at least I did not have lice, but if any appeared I would need sulphur and turpentine put on, and she had this done once and smelled like rotten eggs for days afterwards. Mary lent me a nightdress until mine should be dry, because she'd washed all my clothes, and she wrapped me up in a sheet so I could go out of the laundry and climb up the back stairs, and she said I looked very comical, just like a mad woman. Mary asked Mrs. Honey to give me an advance on my wages for a decent dress, and we got leave to go into the town the very next day. Mrs. Honey preached us a sermon before we set off and said we were to behave modestly and to go and come back straight away and not to speak to any strangers, especially men, and we promised to do as she said. I am afraid, however, that we went the long way around and looked at the flowers in the fenced gardens of the houses and at the shops, which were not nearly so many or so grand as in Belfast from what I had briefly seen there. Then Mary said, would I like to see the street where the whores lived? And I was frightened, but she said there was no danger. I was indeed curious to see the women who made a living by selling their bodies, because I thought if worst came to worst, and if starving, I would still have something to sell. And I wanted to see what they looked like. So we went to Lombard Street. But as it was morning, there was not much to be seen. Mary said that there were several bawdy houses there, although you couldn't tell them from the outside, but inside they were said to be very fancy, with Turkey carpets and crystal chandeliers and velvet curtains, and the whores lived in them with their own bedchambers, and with maids to bring them their breakfasts and clean their floors and make their beds and take out their slops, and all they had to do was put on their clothes and take them off again, and lie around on their backs, and it was easier work than a coal mine or a mill. The ones in these houses were the better class of whore, and the more expensive, and the men were gentlemen, or at least good-paying customers. But the cheaper sort had to walk about outside and make use of rooms rented by the hour, and many of them got diseases, and were old by the time they were 20, and had to cover their faces with paint so as to deceive poor drunken sailors. And although they might look very elegant from a distance, with feathers and satins, up close you could see that their dresses were soiled and ill-fitting, as every stitch on their backs was rented by the day, and they scarcely had enough left over for their bread, and it was a dismal sort of life. And she wondered they did not throw themselves into the lake, which some did, and were often found floating about in the harbor. I wondered how Mary knew so much about it. But she laughed and said that I would hear a lot if I kept my ears open, especially in the kitchen. But also a girl she'd known from the country had gone to the bad, and she used to meet her on the street. But what had become of her since she didn't know, and feared it was nothing good. After that we went to King Street, to a dry goods shop where ends of bales were sold cheaply, and there were silks and cottons and broadcloths and flannels and satins and tartans, and everything you could desire, but we had to consider the price and the use it was to be put to. In the end, we bought a serviceable blue and white gingham, and Mary said she would help me make it up, though she was surprised when the time came to find I could sew so well and with such tiny stitches, and said I was wasted as a servant and ought to set up as a dressmaker. We bought the thread for the dress and also the buttons from a peddler who came round the next day and was well known to all there. He was a great favorite with cook, who made him a cup of tea and cut him a slice of cake while he opened up his pack and spread out his wares. His name was Jeremiah, and when he came up the drive to the back door, he was followed by a band of 5 or 6 raggedy urchins, like a parade, and one was banging on a pot with a spoon, and all were singing, "Jeremiah, blow the fire, puff, puff, puff. First you blow it gently, then you blow it rough." The racket brought us all to the window, and when they'd reached the back door, he gave them a penny to spend, and they ran off. And when cook asked him what all that was about, he said he would rather have them following under his command than pelting him with clots of mud and horse dung, which was their habit with peddlers, who could not chase them away without abandoning their packs, which, if they did, would swiftly be pillaged by the little ruffians. So he'd chosen the wiser course and employed them, and taught them the song himself. This Jeremiah was a deft and nimble man, with long nose and legs, and a skin all brown by the sun, and a curling black beard, and Mary said that although he looked like a Jew or a gypsy, as many peddlers were, he was a Yankee, with an Italian father who'd come over to work in the mills in Massachusetts, and his last name was Pontelli. But he was well-liked. He spoke good English, yet with something foreign in his voice, and he had piercing black eyes and a wide, handsome smile, and flattered the women shamelessly. He had a great many things I wanted to buy, but could not afford to, even though he said he would take half the money now and leave the rest until the next time he came. But I do not like being in debt. He had ribbons and laces, as well as the thread and buttons, which were metal, or mother-of-pearl, or wood, or bone, and I chose the bone, and white cotton stockings, and collars and cuffs, and cravats and handkerchiefs, and several petticoats, and two pairs of stays, used, but well washed and almost as good as new, and summer gloves in pale shades most beautifully made, and earrings, silver and gold in color, although Mary said they would rub off, and a real silver snuff-box, and bottles of scent that smelled like roses, very strong. Cook bought some, and Jeremiah said she scarcely needed it, as she smelled like a princess already. And she blushed and giggled, even though she was nearing 50 and not of a graceful figure. And she said, "Onions, more like." And he said she smelled good enough to eat, and the way to a man's heart was through his stomach. And then he smiled with his large white teeth, which looked all the larger and whiter due to his dark beard, and gave Cook a hungry stare and licked his lips, as if she herself was a delicious cake he longed to devour, at which she blushed even more. Then he asked us if we had anything to sell, for as we knew, he gave good prices. And Agnes sold her coral earrings that she had from an aunt, as being vanity, but we knew she needed the money for her sister, who was in difficulties. And Jim from the stables came in and said he would trade a shirt he had, and also a large colored handkerchief for another and finer shirt he liked better. And with a wooden-handled pocket knife thrown into the bargain, it was done. While Jeremiah was in the kitchen, it was like a party. And Mrs. Honey came to find out what was making all the commotion. And she said, "Well, Jeremiah, I see you are up to your old pranks, taking advantage of the women again." But she smiled while saying it, which was a rare sight. And he said, yes, that was what he was doing. There were so many pretty ones he could not resist, but none so pretty as she. And she bought two lawn handkerchiefs from him, although she did say he had to be brisk about it and not take all day, as the girls had their work to do. And she clanked away out of the kitchen. Some wanted him to tell their fortunes by looking into their hands, but Agnes said it was meddling with the devil, and that Mrs. Alderman Parkinson would not want word to get around of such gypsy doings in her kitchen, so he did not. But after much pleading, he did an imitation of a gentleman, with a voice and manners and all, at which we clapped our hands with joy. It was so lifelike. And he made a silver coin appear out of Cook's ear and showed us how he could swallow a fork, or appear to. He said these were conjuring tricks he had learnt in the days of his wicked youth, when he was a wild lad and worked at fairs, before he'd become an honest tradesman, and had his pocket picked and his heart broken 50 times over by cruel and pretty girls such as we were, and all present laughed. But when he'd stowed everything away in his pack again, and had drunk his cup of tea and eaten a slice of cake, and said nobody made such good cakes as Cook did, and was going away, he motioned me over to him, and gave me an extra bone button to go with the four I'd bought. He put it into my hand and folded my fingers over it, and his own fingers were hard and dry like sand. But he peered into my hand swiftly first, and then he said, 5 for luck, for people of that kind consider 4 an unlucky number, and odd numbers luckier than even ones. And he gave me a quick and intelligent look with his shining black eyes, and he said, quite low so that the others did not hear it, "There are sharp rocks ahead, which I suppose there always are, sir, and there had certainly been enough of them behind, and I had survived them, so I was not too daunted by that. But then he said the strangest thing of all to me. He said, 'You are one of us.' And then he shouldered his pack and took up his staff and walked away, and I was left wondering what he'd meant. But after I had mulled it over, I decided he meant that I, too, was homeless and a wanderer, like the peddlers and those who worked at fairs. For I couldn't imagine what else he might have had in mind. We all felt a little stale and flat after he'd gone, for it wasn't often that those of us in the back rooms and offices were allowed a treat like that. and a good look at such pretty things, and a chance to laugh and fun in the middle of the day. But the dress came out very well, and because there were 5 buttons and not 4, we used 3 at the neck and 1 on each of the sleeve cuffs. And even Mrs. Honey said what a difference it made in my appearance and how trim and respectable I looked. Now,